Hamas has a new leader.
Yahya Sinwar's unanimous appointment as Hamas's new political chief shows that Gaza is now center stage.
Police fired tear gas at anti-government protesters in Kenya.
Our people, unite!
Shops were shut and streets left deserted after riot police set up roadblocks and threw tear gas canisters.
And an entire community of homes is almost complete. And they were printed.
One layer at a time, Vulcan prints a full house. It goes from the front of the slab to the back for one layer. And for these homes in particular, after 10 feet of printing in a few days, you have the wall system for a house.
Today is Friday, August 9th, and this is VOA's International Edition. I'm Alexis Strobe. Hamas leader Yahya Sinwar, believed to be the architect of the October 7th attacks on Israel, is now the Palestinian terror group's new political chief, as well as its military leader based in Gaza. Analysts say Sinwar is unlikely to conclude a ceasefire deal with Israel to end fighting in Gaza and return hostages. But a Hamas spokesman says Sinwar will continue negotiations. Dale Gavlak reports from Amman.
Nicholas Harris of Washington's New Lines Institute tells VOA Yahya Sinwar's unanimous appointment as Hamas's new political chief shows that Gaza is now center stage and not Qatar, where the political leadership has been based.
Now, Hamas is making a very clear statement to the world, not just to Israel, the United States, Qatar, or Egypt, that the path for Hamas runs through Gaza. And fundamentally, Hamas is willing to fight until the very bitter end, not only for its own survival as an organization, but from its point of view, for the future of the Palestinian people. Hamas is signaling to the Israelis and whomever works with them that there is no way to separate Gaza and the future of Gaza from Hamas.
U.S. Secretary of State Antony Blinken says it's now up to Yahya Sinwar to clinch a ceasefire deal in the 10-month Gaza conflict because he has been and remains the primary decider. This indicates that was the case even when top Hamas negotiator Ismail Haniyeh, considered relatively more moderate, was still alive. Khaled Haroub, a Hamas specialist at Northwestern University in Qatar, told France's Le Monde newspaper that if Israel, the United States, and their allies in the region and beyond were hoping to subdue Hamas by force, the response will be a more radical Hamas. He said he does not see a softening of the group's position as Washington and Qatar try to reach a deal in hopes of reducing the current escalation between Israel and Iran. Cynthia Bianco, a Gulf specialist at the European Council on Foreign Relations, tells VOA that Qatar has tried for 8 months to see a deal happen. But Hamas really takes its cues from Iran.
They only respond to Iran and perhaps to other external backers, to some extent, Russia and China as well. The political cause and the military cause are one and the same. That means that Qatar's leverage is also less.
Israeli and U.S. intelligence officers told the New York Times that Sinwar's strategy is to keep the war in Gaza going for as long as it takes to shred Israel's international reputation and to damage its relationship with its primary ally, the United States. Nicholas Harris says he sees Sinwar both influenced by slain Iranian Republican Guard Corps General Qasem Soleimani and using his Israel playbook. Harris said Soleimani developed an entire strategy to create a network of proxies and partners that surround Israel, including Hamas, to seek its destruction.
Series of attritional conflicts with Israel will undermine the foundation of Israel economically, socially, politically, and then geopolitically. All those elements have been present in this current conflict that Hamas initiated on October 7, 2023. And we're seeing this Soleimani playbook continue to be enacted.
Observers say they see both Sinwar and Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu as unwilling to reach a ceasefire agreement for their own political reasons. Dale Gavlak, VOA News, Amman.
As tensions continue to rise in the Middle East, the U.S. military continues posture changes in the region. According to U.S. Central Command, Air Force F-22 fighter jets have arrived in the U.S. Central Command area of responsibility to mitigate the possibility of regional escalation by Iran or its proxies. Russian and Ukrainian forces clashed in Russia's Kursk region for a third consecutive day Thursday, according to Russia's defense ministry. But while Ukrainian officials are saying little, the incursion appears to have the blessing of the United States. VOA national security correspondent Jeff Selden reports.
A house in Russia's Kursk region on fire. Video from the Russian media outlet Izvestia showing the apparent aftermath of the Ukrainian incursion. Ukrainian officials have been silent on the operation, which appears to be one of the biggest cross-border forays by Ukraine into Russia since Moscow launched its invasion of Ukraine more than 2 years ago. So far, though, the Ukrainian maneuver has the support of the U.S.
Yes, it is. It is consistent with our policy.
Pentagon spokesperson Sabrina Singh telling reporters the U.S. still does not support any long-range Ukrainian attacks into Russia. But she says this is different.
They are taking actions to protect themselves from attacks that are coming from a region that are within the U.S. policy of where they can operate, our weapons, our systems, our capabilities.
Singh also says the U.S. sees the Ukrainian actions advancing by some estimates as far as 10 kilometers into Russia as defensive.
As they see attacks coming across the border, they have to be able to have the capabilities to respond. And so you're seeing some of these cross-border counterfire measures.
Russian defense officials say the Ukrainian incursion has been suppressed. Still, some Russian civilians are leaving. We began to evacuate. Kursk region acting governor Alexei Smirnov said Thursday, talking to Russian President Vladimir Putin on a video call, he accused Ukrainian forces of targeting civilian structures. Jeff Selden, VOA News, Washington.
During an interview on CBS, U.S. President Joe Biden says he was not confident about a peaceful transfer of power if Republican presidential candidate Donald Trump were to lose the November 5th election. Trump refuted that during a news conference on Thursday.
Of course there'll be a peaceful transfer, and there was last time, and there'll be a peaceful transfer. I just hope we're going to have honest elections, that's all, okay?
During the news conference, Trump also said he has agreed to several debates with Democratic presidential candidate Kamala Harris, including a debate on ABC. He had previously said he wouldn't commit to that particular debate because President Joe Biden was no longer the Democratic presidential candidate he would face.
We've agreed with Fox on a date of September 4th. We've agreed with NBC, fairly full agreement subject to them, on September 10th, and we've agreed with ABC on September 25th.
At the debates, foreign policy is likely to be a key topic. Congressional Republicans closely align with former President Trump on a number of key foreign policy issues, including U.S. support for Israel. But as VOA's congressional correspondent Catherine Gibson reports, lawmakers still have significant differences on China, tariff policy, and aid to Ukraine that could complicate a second Trump term.
Former President Donald Trump meeting with Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu last month.
No president has done what I've done for Israel, and we've always had a very good relationship.
Trump has previously criticized Netanyahu for security failures he claims enabled the October 7th Hamas attack. Unpredictability was a hallmark of Trump's foreign policy while in office. One analyst told VOA the Republican Party's 2024 foreign policy platform reflects that.
There are not a ton of specifics. That gives him the advantage of being able to shape a policy in a way that he sees fit in the moment rather than getting locked into policies at the outset of a term.
Trump's fellow Republicans claim the social media app TikTok is controlled by the Chinese government and can be used to access user information and influence political beliefs.
I do not want the Chinese Communist Party getting personal data about our citizens, nor being able to have algorithms that would propagandize the American public.
But Trump reversed his position on banning TikTok this year.
We're going to save TikTok. They want to destroy TikTok. So all of the people on TikTok Vote for Trump.
Trump has also criticized NATO, claiming member countries do not pay their fair share for the common defense. His running mate, vice presidential nominee J.D. Vance, has been even more critical of the United States sending aid money to Ukraine.
But let's not mistake the courage of the Ukrainian troops on the ground with the fact that they have the most corrupt leadership and corrupt government in Europe, and maybe the most corrupt leadership anywhere in the world.
That is in direct opposition to Senate Majority Leader Mitch McConnell, who has argued aid to Ukraine is essential to defending democracy in Europe.
It's no longer a settled question that America will meet aggression with overwhelming force, or even that we'll back our allies 100%.
Analysts say Trump's calls to raise tariffs if he is elected to a second term could cause the most conflict with Republican lawmakers.
It shows the transformation of the Republican Party since 2016, because the Republicans historically have been free traders.
Trump has pledged to introduce at least 60% tariffs on China and 10% tariffs on imports from other countries if he is reelected. Catherine Gibson, VOA News.
We're following these other stories from around the world. Austrian authorities say both suspects in a foiled plot to attack Taylor Swift's shows in Vienna appeared to be inspired by the Islamic State group and Al-Qaeda. They said Thursday that investigators found bomb-making materials at one of their homes. Officials said one of the two confessed to planning to, quote, kill as many people as possible outside the concert venue. Three sold-out concerts were canceled a day earlier because of the plot. Authorities say the death toll from nearly 6 weeks of monsoon rains across Pakistan has risen to 156. The National Disaster Management Authority says flash floods and heavy rains have damaged more than 1,800 homes since July 1st, when the monsoon rains began. Thursday's report says orchards were also damaged in remote areas of the southwestern Balochistan province. Federal investigators say they have found the DNA of a former U.S. Green Beret on some of the 60 automatic weapons he allegedly smuggled from Florida to South America as part of a failed 2020 coup attempt against Venezuelan President Nicolas Maduro. The allegations in court papers filed days after Jordan Goudreau's arrest last week marked the strongest evidence yet linking him to illegal arms trafficking related to the failed raid. The attempted coup ended with several fighters killed and two of Goudreau's former U.S. Special Forces colleagues locked away for years in Venezuela. On Thursday, police used tear gas to disperse pockets of anti-government protesters gathered in Kenya's capital, Nairobi. Protesters want President William Ruto to step down. Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo has more.
That protest movement is seeking to compel President William Ruto to resign. Shops were shut and streets left deserted after riot police set up roadblocks and threw tear gas canisters to disperse protesters across Nairobi's financial district. The Nani Nani March, meaning 8-8 in reference to the date, follows weeks of similar pro-reform protests that saw Ruto scrap planned tax hikes and overhaul his cabinet. Mostly organized online, the youth-led nationwide protests have no official leaders. They began peacefully in June before turning violent, killing more than 50 people. Ruto bowed to pressure and shelved the new taxes in June after some demonstrators briefly stormed parliament. He also fired his entire cabinet, apart from the foreign minister, last month. The president's reconstituted cabinet, including opposition member, was sworn in on Thursday. Ruto has promised to investigate alleged abuses by the police during demonstrations, but has broadly defended their conduct.
That was Reuters correspondent Alice Rizzo. Bangladesh's Nobel Peace Prize-winning economist Muhammad Yunus was sworn in as the head of the country's caretaker government on Thursday, 3 days after Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina was forced to flee the country following violent protests. Rachel Graham from Reuters has the story.
Yunus made an emotional return home to Bangladesh after weeks of student protests killed about 300 people and injured thousands, forcing Prime Minister Sheikh Hasina to resign and flee to neighbouring India. A harsh critic of Hasina, the 84-year-old arrived in Dhaka from Paris, where he'd been receiving medical treatment. Protesters had backed him to head the caretaker government, which is tasked with holding elections for a new leader. People in the capital, Dhaka, welcomed his appointment, hoping for a new era in Bangladeshi politics.
The example that the young generation has set of giving this country a rebirth, we are expecting that Yunus will be able to take it further to reconstruct our nation.
I earnestly request the new government to put an end to bad politics in the country so the poor working class can live in peace.
The Economist, known as the Banker to the Poor, received the 2006 Nobel Peace Prize for founding a bank that pioneered the fight against poverty through small loans to needy borrowers. Yunus was sworn in as chief of a team of advisors at the official residence of President Mohammad Shahabuddin. Two student leaders in their 20s who led the protests, Nahid Islam and Asif Mahmood, will also join the caretaker government, local media reported. Hasina's Awami League party does not figure in the interim government after she resigned on Monday. In a post on Facebook, her son said the party had not given up and was ready to hold talks with opponents and the interim government. Hasina's flight from the country came after she ruled for 20 of the last 30 years, after winning a fourth straight term in January. The student-led movement that ousted Hasina grew out of protests against quotas in government jobs that spiralled in July, provoking a violent crackdown, though the government denied excessive use of force. The protests were fuelled also by harsh economic conditions and political repression in the country.
Reuters correspondent Rachel Graham. VOA's International Edition continues. I'm Alexis Strope. Venezuelan security forces have arrested thousands in the wake of last week's massive protests by opponents of President Nicolas Maduro, who say he stole the country's July 28th election. As Jan Boschat reports from Caracas, the latest repression targets Venezuela's poorest residents, who until now had been Maduro's main base of support.
It was the first time in 25 years that people who live in the capital's slums hit the streets to protest against Chavismo, the ideology behind the leftist government that have ruled Venezuela for decades. It caught both the government and the opposition by surprise. Less than 24 hours after Nicolas Maduro claimed victory in the elections, residents of the poorest neighborhoods in Caracas took to the streets, some banging pots and pans, all of them outraged by an election that the opposition claims was rigged.
We are here because of the electoral fraud, the deceit committed against the people of Venezuela. We are now tired of being oppressed in this country, which is so beautiful, so wonderful.
Soon, a crowd began walking toward the city center. They came from the many barrios or neighborhoods of Petare, a group of slums in Caracas with about 400,000 inhabitants. They were stopped by the security forces with violence. And they fought back while they could. Thus began a week of brutal repression, which by Wednesday left more than 20 dead and about 2,000 people in prison. The repression targeted the poorest segments of the population, those who had been the base of support for Chavismo for 2.5 decades, and who were now calling for a change in the streets of Venezuela. Now, many are missing, and their families search for answers.
They gave me some information on what they're accusing him of and why. I mean, why don't they tell me anything about him? And I go and ask, and they still don't tell me anything.
Hernan Garcia is looking for his son. At the doors of the detention centers in Caracas, hundreds like him were looking for information about their missing relatives. Almost all of them were people from poor neighborhoods. There was hardly anyone from the traditional Chavista opposition in Venezuela. Almost always middle class, almost always well-educated. Maduro's forces have targeted the poorer population to prevent the slums from continuing to rise in protest. Both the government and the opposition agree that only the poorest communities could be capable of destabilizing the government. They were the most loyal until last week. The response has been harsh against those who dare to protest in the heart of Chavismo.
We know they're being presented in terrorism courts, and one of the crimes they're being charged with is terrorism. It's a very serious offense since the penalty involves 30 years in prison just for the crime of terrorism. In other words, it's the maximum penalty we have in Venezuela.
Maduro promises no forgiveness and harsh penalties for those he labels as terrorists. Among the penalties, he suggests, will be forced labor. Yabuesha, VOA News, Caracas.
Last month was the second hottest July globally on record, ending a 13-month streak of global record temperatures, the European Union's Copernicus Climate Change Service said on Wednesday. Siakir Jasny from Reuters reports.
The month was 2.7 degrees Fahrenheit above the pre-industrial average, still high, but also short of July in 2023. Beginning June last year, the streak saw each month become the hottest on record since 1940. Copernicus links high temperatures mainly to greenhouse emissions from fossil fuels. Julian Nicholas is a scientist with the service and pointed out that the recent streak went beyond the El Niño phenomenon.
I think that's really something to keep in mind. I think it was the streak top record of global temperature record was in part related to development and of the El Niño event. In the Pacific, has come to an end, but there is also other part of the world that are still very warm, much warmer than average. And again, the consequences of climate change will continue to be felt even beyond the end of the recent streaks of global temperature records. So that's really the context that we need to keep in mind.
Above average temperatures were seen around the globe in Southern and Eastern Europe, the Western US, Western Canada, as well as Africa, the Middle East, Asia, and Eastern Antarctica. Ocean surface temperatures also stayed unusually high in many areas.
What is still surprising at this time, as we speak in early August, is the very record, near record levels of sea surface temperatures, global sea surface temperature. We are slightly below what we were a year ago.
That was Reuters correspondent Siakir Jasny. And finally,
one layer at a time, Vulcan prints a full house.
Like any desktop 3D printer, the 3D printing company Icon's Vulcan printer goes layer by layer to build an object. Except this printer is more than 45 feet wide, weighs 4.75 tons, and prints residential homes. Connor Jenkins is Icon's senior project manager.
The feedback that we're getting from homeowners is how exciting it is to have a different choice in the material. So our different layers provide this kind of corduroy effect, which can actually be really soft and be a great experience for homeowners.
This summer, the robotic printer is finishing the last few homes of 100 3D printed houses in Wolf Ranch, a community in Georgetown, Texas, about 30 miles from Austin. Icon calls it the world's largest 3D printed community and began printing the walls of homes here in November 2022. Compared with to traditional construction, the company says that 3D printing homes is faster, less expensive, requires fewer workers, and minimizes waste of construction materials.
So given the housing shortage that our country's dealing with, and especially for affordably priced homes, it's never been more important for us to innovate, to find new methods of constructing homes that enhances how we build the homes and how our customers live in those homes.
And what's it like inside a 3D printed home? Angela Hontas says it's cool.
It feels very cool. We keep the house at 75, which is probably insane to people in a Texas summer. I think a lot of people keep it like 70 or under, and it feels relatively cool. The concrete floors are very cool, literally. The quietness. We're right next to a bypass and you can't hear anything, so it's very quiet.
This has been International Edition on the Voice of America. On behalf of everyone at VOA, thank you for joining us. For pictures, stories, videos, and more, follow VOA News on your favorite social media platform and online at voanews.com. In Washington, I'm Alexis Strope.